Welcome to the No Chum Alone Zone. Whether you're in your car or at home listening to this, understand that you're not fools, even though the political class thinks of you as fools. And many in the media talk down to you, just like you were a bunch of chumbalones. But you're not. And we'll talk about this and other things today with Matt Rosenberg, the son of Milt Rosenberg, author of a new book, What's Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. It's a good book. Read it. And you know something? I'm a native son. I was born at 52nd in Peoria with the smell of the stockyards in my nose. And guess what? I'm pissed off too. Rosenberg understands what's wrong. Jay Levine understands it too. Writing in a guest column the other day on johncastnews.com about what's killing Chicago. It's the violence, stupid. Let's just take a look at the last few days. At least 43 people shot, 6 fatally, in a violent Chicago weekend. 3 armed carjackings within hours on the north and northwest sides. 1 person critically wounded. And the Sun-Times reports that prosecutors reject charges against 5 suspects in a deadly gang-related gunfight in Austin. It's just like the Wild West, says the headline. According to the Sun-Times, Cook County State's Attorney Kim Fox rejected charges because, well, they were all mutual combatants, unquote. Are you kidding me? Mutual combatants? If this story's true, then every Democrat and every news organization and every editorial board and every pundit should rip on Fox. But they won't. She's somehow protected by the woke. And all I hear are crickets. Listen up, chumbalones. Listen up to the sound of how you're being herded. Senator Durbin said the other day that he and his wife were stuck in the middle of a gang shootout on Lakeshore Drive.
Last Saturday night, my wife and I went out to eat downtown Chicago with another couple, several couples, and we were driving home on Lakeshore Drive at about 10 o'clock on Saturday night. I heard a popping sound. I didn't know what it was, but the driver of the car said, "Those are gunshots." And it turned out to be the car next to us. And the driver was leaning out the window and shooting a gun in the air. He could have just as easily been shooting the gun at us. And sadly, that's what happens way too often.
And David Axelrod, the media mouthpiece for Rich Daley, Rahm, and Barack Obama, all 3 of them responsible for a hollowed-out city, says Lightfoot must declare a public safety emergency, as per this report by Mike Flannery on Fox Chicago.
Former President Obama's senior White House advisor David Axelrod tells me on tonight's edition of Flannery Fired Up that the time is long past due for Mayor Lightfoot to declare a public safety emergency here. He noted the FBI's report that killings spiked 56% in Chicago last year. They're now higher still so far this year, with more than 3,500 people shot, more than 650 shot dead.
And it requires the mayor to do what mayors don't like to do, which is to say, this is more than we can handle. Here at city government, we need everyone at the table. We've got a public safety emergency. If not, you know, this is going to be on her account if she runs for re-election in 2023.
And here's the punchline, because you're not chumbalones.
So you think Axelrod and Senator Durbin have had it with this crap? Both men, by the way, had praise today for the Chicago CRED anti-violence program, one run by Arnie Duncan, the former Secretary of Education in the Obama administration. Axelrod says the program and others like it must be scaled up enormously.
And who benefits? Cui bono. Cui bono. Who benefits? Arnie Duncan? So we run around, hands in the air, saying, "Save us, Arnie Duncan. Save us, White Shadow, Arnie Duncan." Isn't it amazing how this all works out? Think of what I've been telling you for weeks now about Chicago politics and being herded. Durbin announces the horror. David Axelrod jumps in, pushing Lightfoot to declare an emergency, that the violence is beyond her capabilities. Axelrod runs a think tank at the University of Chicago. He was Daley's mouthpiece, and Rahm's, and Obama. And Obama ignored Chicago when he was president, but now he wants his giant temple of adoration and fealty. And I just wanted you to pay attention to how Chicago is being herded. Lightfoot has lost the city. Kim Fox and her crew pushed it over the edge. Lightfoot wears the jacket because she's basically a political fool. And every day brings stories of more violence. But is the White Shadow capable? Or isn't he just the meat puppet for the Obama Daley Rahm clique who now want to take it back because Lightfoot was an aberration and now they want their city? Think. Understand the play. See what they're doing. They're hurting you. Hurting you. To the voting chutes. Jeff Carlin is here, as always. My friend and co-host, executive producer at WGN Radio. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, mild-mannered columnist at johncassnews.com. And where are you? As Chicago floats face down in the river of anarchy and violence, as gang wars erupt on downtown streets, as Lightfoot sends her emissary, Police Superintendent David Brown, to make nice with Boss Preckwinkle's protege, the catch-and-release State's Attorney Kim Fox, who seems protected by Chicago media. And where are you as the White Shadow is rolled out, as the city's savior, with many in the media playing along? That's why you're here, with us, on the Boulevard of Broken Dreams, on the Chicago Way podcast, on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand, with pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward, with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
We're here with Matt Rosenberg, talking about his new book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. Matt grew up here. He is the son of Milton Rosenberg, the esteemed professor at the University of Chicago, a friend of mine. He loved his martinis when we were done recording. I met so many people on his show. And this book is a groundbreaker. Matt, one thing I noticed when you walked across the city, what did you see when you walked across the city writing What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son?
I saw a lot of empty space. I saw a fair amount of desolation. I saw really reflections of danger and dysfunction. But I also saw and met people who told me success stories. I saw hope. I saw hope in places you might not expect. In Woodlawn. Certainly in Pullman, in Washington Heights, sitting at the kitchen table of a 40-something black couple who had totally turned their lives around. In West Garfield Park, sitting with a charter school operator, I saw and felt a great deal of hope for what Sam Finkelstein was doing at Legal Prep Charter High School. So the full gamut. The absolutely full gamut of everything. But most of all, I saw the need for change, I got to say.
There is an element of hope in the book, but also anger, and righteously so.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You know, and it was kind of a two-prong effort, John, as you know, from reading it. I dug into the policy research and the political history of this place, but I felt, you know, I moved into Bridgeport for 6 weeks, which was a good move, I think. And it wasn't too far to get down into Roseland, into Englewood. I spent some time in Englewood with a great guy named Daryl Smith, really oriented me toward everything. And his life story was another remarkable one. Here's a guy who, you know, did 3 years on an involuntary manslaughter rap when he was 18. He happened to be in a car when some bad stuff went down. And when he came out, he faced that fork in the road and he chose the straight life. And now here he is at the age of 51, the unofficial mayor of Englewood, owns 10 residential properties involved in violence prevention, neighborhood economic development, charitable work in like 10 different directions. Quite a guy. And, you know, it turns out he lives about a block south of where one of those mass shootings occurred in June, when Lightfoot decided to channel John Lennon singing Imagine a World Without Guns, you know, that one. So Daryl's really in the thick of it. So I just saw a whole lot. And, you know, I almost titled the book The Only White Guy on the Bus, because that's what I was. But this really wasn't about me. There was a little bit of memoir in there for sure. And I wanted to put that in there. But there's an awful lot. And so it leaves us, you know, asking, I hope, what's in the title? What next Chicago? Who does what, when and how, right?
It's a great concept. I mean, it's one of those things in your book that I always felt about, you know, like you said, the one white guy on the bus moving into a situation to try to observe it from an outsider. Because I mean, I kid who grew up in the suburbs, but, you know, I was living in the city now for over a decade, but worked in for family from the city and all that type of stuff. I always wonder about firsthand experience, because everything we get is from someone else in theory, right? And you see a lot firsthand in your writing about how the city is hurting. And that's kind of the premise for like, what's next? How do we fix this? Right. Mm-hmm. What's some of the stuff that really stuck out to you or maybe the cause of some of the stuff that really stuck out to you as to what the city needs to move forward in a better way?
Well, for example, I sat down with a young man named Jesse Mack, who now is the development officer at Urban Prep Charter High Schools, which runs 3 charter high schools, public charter high schools for young men. And listening to Jesse's story, that helped shine a light for me on things the city needs to do. And some of this stuff isn't new, but that makes it actually more pressing as opposed to less pressing. He went to a K-8 elementary school in Englewood that was non-charter. And one thing he told me that stuck with me was, you know, he had teachers that weren't getting through to the students and the teachers seemed not to care about that. They weren't making an extra effort to put knowledge across to students that they weren't really successfully delivering the inspiration and the knowledge to. And Jesse was a pretty capable kid. He'd come up, you know, really kind of hard with no dad and then a violent stepdad, a mom who turned her life around. She was first kind of trapped in addiction, but ended up getting a master's in psychology. And she was very religious. And there's a strong thread of faith and family throughout this book. And Jesse's story is an example of how important that can be. But there was a big contrast when he managed to get in through lottery to really, I think, the first class of the East Englewood facility of Urban Prep Charter High School. And there were these black men who were college educated and dressed in blazers and really accented how you comport yourself and mastery of the material. And it was a huge difference. So one thing I learned or was reminded of really in listening to Jesse's story was the importance of teaching that goes the extra mile. And then that takes us into a whole set of issues that we know all too well about, you know, You know, the cap on charter schools, the new moratorium again on closure of under-enrolled schools that Democratic legislators in Springfield snuck into the Chicago elected school board bill. We get really sort of to the primacy of expanding school choice, choices for families versus constricting it, you know, and that's huge when we talk about the violence that's just absolutely chewing up this city. It's remarkable and dismaying and insane. We have to come back to education, and we have to come back to the home too. We're talking about the failure of institutions here across the board. So it's a lot, right?
Sure, yeah.
We're talking to Matt Rosenberg, author of a great new book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Son. It's out now. Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son, pardon me. It's out now, and you can get it online. You can order it on Amazon. You can get it at the bookstores. Good luck with it, Matt. But I'd like to ask you, part of this is your evolution as well. You didn't start off in life as a conservative, and you certainly, from what I understand, I mean, I don't think working for, you know, stamping out envelopes for Edmund Muskie is, or was it McGovern?
Eugene McCarthy.
McCarthy, pardon me. Yes, of course. That's not generally the road to the National Review. So how did that work? And I assume that your family was quite progressive, living in Hyde Park at one time. Mm-hmm. And then reason came in and intellectual honesty came in and things changed for you guys. Tell us about that.
You bet, John. And that's about the size of it. It was a long, slow process. I grew up in Hyde Park in the 1960s. My parents were both very involved in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I mean, I remember carrying a sign at a protest after it was actually Nixon who called student protesters bums, carrying a sign that said "Bums for Peace," marching around in front of the Picasso statue. And I was forcibly dragooned into the Eugene McCarthy for President campaign in 1968. But over time, yeah, my perspective changed. And, you know, it might have begun to change just a little bit when I worked on the Mirage investigation in the summer of 1977. I was just kind of Forrest Gump, you know, right place, right time. Happened to be working as an intern with a guy named Bill Rechtenwald at the who recently passed away quite sadly. Really kind of a quiet giant in Chicago journalism at that time. And of course, as you know, he spent a good many years at the Tribune doing this kind of great shoe leather reporting. But at that time, he was the chief investigator of the Better Government Association. And we ended up working that summer on an investigation that some people still remember, called Mirage Tavern, undercover thing, where basically, and Pam Zekman, of course, was a crucial part of that, one of the real greats in Chicago journalism. And, you know, I was just a wet behind the ears kid along for the ride, but I was part of the undercover team. So I got to see what went on. And so that formed my consciousness too, John, the system that you and Jeff and many others know all too well about. You know, that envelope tucked inside the folded newspaper left on the bench seat, you know, how many Chicago aldermen have used that one themselves? But from there, you know, there was more. And I went and worked as a reporter in the suburbs for the late and sometimes great Lerner newspapers, right around O'Hare, covering Bensonville, Wooddale, and Itasca. And that put me then in the early, mid-80s. Right in the middle of the O'Hare Airport and the regional airport policy controversy. And it was so much more than, you know, what John Cullerton once said, a bunch of hysterical housewives upset about jet noise. Yeah, a Democrat actually said that. Maybe that affected my political evolution too. But when it came to the, you know, the wars over the new airport, Piatone versus Lake Calumet, looking at how the city ran the whole airport contracting set up, that had an effect on me. So over time, all of those things. And then really the biggest thing, guys, is just looking at urban progressive governance and looking at the state of cities. And so, you know, that's a long flow over several decades, but it seemed to really come to a head in 2020. And so there I am back in Seattle, having lived in Chicago for a good part of 30 years, you know, 1964 to 1994. So childhood, teen years, young adulthood, coming of age, starting my career, I feel very, very connected to this place. It's still my home, and managed to get out, raise our kids in Seattle, always came back. And then seeing what was going on in all of the cities after the death of George Floyd, the horrible, completely unwarranted death of George Floyd at the hands of that Minneapolis cop. And then just looking at everything going out the window in Chicago, I felt like I had to come back. But John, I suppose a succinct answer to your question is, you know, it's like I think Norman Podhoretz once said, one of the founders of Commentary Magazine, he went through the same evolution, and someone asked him to explain it. And he said, I got mugged by reality.
So. Yes. I think there are parallel tracks here, because I was not always the right-wing conservative curmudgeon that people take me to be. Mm. And I was quite liberal. But then I began covering Chicago government, Chicago politics, and saw it from the inside, and saw the hammer of government raining down on whoever wasn't in the, you know, in the favored crew. And even more so, your commentary on schools, I think, for me at least, charter schools are good. Complete and utter free school choice is better. And I think that these school systems, public school systems in the urban areas that basically relegate generations of minority kids to substandard education is the civil rights issue of our time.
I agree. And I think one good thing that happened in Illinois, and it's going to be telling to see if it moves from being a pilot program to a permanent program, is the Invest in Kids private school scholarship incentive through the 75% state income tax credit. And it's been quite interesting and not terribly difficult to track the political fortunes of that program. And we know that two times since it was started under Rauner, when the Democratic legislature needed to throw him a large bone in order to get an education funding bill passed, that since its creation a few years back, two times now, our billionaire Democrat governor has tried to cut it off at the knees, and two times he has failed, because minority parents, students, and teachers at private schools have come down to Springfield, and what do you know? They're great lobbyists, maybe the best of all, because they're real people. And there's a fairly solid chance that this coming year it might be turned into a permanent program, not just a pilot. And we need more choice. There was something that occurred during COVID nationally. The Wall Street Journal wrote about this a little, called micro schools, where parents who couldn't be at home to watch over their kids sort of farmed it out. And these were public charter school parents. And through the public charter schools, there were sort of off-site satellites set up, these little micro schools, maybe just five or six kids in someone's living room or rec room. And there were minders and instructors to make sure that they were connecting well online with their public charter school instructors remotely over their computers. And, you know, maybe that's something going forward. The attendance was solid. The participation was meaningful. And, you know, who knows what the next pandemic is going to be like, how serious it will be. And we can't afford to have the kind of drop off from learning that we had in Chicago. So there's a whole lot there in education. There's an awful lot that I get into also in other policy areas in the book, including policing strategies and tactics, the way we look at the role of parents in terms of controlling these young men that are running off the rails and making the city a dangerous and really kind of freaky place to live, unfortunately. There's quite a bit about reforming the rigged rules of governance, the importance of independent mapping for the city council.
We'll see about that. Independent mapping, right?
Yeah. I know that one is. And you know, I put a fair amount of emphasis on the fact that Lori Lightfoot came in as a political reformer and has dropped a number of her, you know, promises. Granted, this stuff isn't easy. And I really think, you know, the way we talk about race in this city is huge, too. So, you know, take your pick.
In your book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son, Matt Rosenberg talks about the ward remap and notes that Lori Lightfoot, when she was a reformer, supported the idea of an independent map, basically tied to community areas rather than, you know, selecting by race. Mm-hmm. But all that seems to have changed, Matt.
It certainly has, John. And she, on the one hand, is dealing with real life politics. But let's look at those real life politics. You have essentially Latino aldermen saying, we still want our Latino wards, and Black aldermen saying, we still want our Black wards. And my response is, yeah, and that's worked so well for all these years. And in a way, and I'm sort of leapfrogging here, John, but that takes us to our whole conversation about race. Another aspect of what goes on in this town is, you know, racial essentialism. We see it being manifested in a slightly different way by the mayor, who, as I'm sure you guys know all too well, tends to explain every disparity, every difference, every big problem afflicting this city as a matter of systemic racism. And what we really have is now systemic misrule by an urban political elite that is of color. And, you know, Democrats have basically run this city since about 1931, when Big Bill Thompson was shown the door again for the last time. And look where we are now. And it's not as if Chicago was alone here. So I come to the conclusion that it's really time to move fast and break things, but that it can't happen without a sort of a bottom-up uprising. And, you know, some examples of things that need to happen are a complete reform of the way we do public contracting, and moving our local elections to presidential election dates, which, as I understand it, would take a change in state law. But we change a lot of things in Springfield. But the idea that 33% of registered voters are going to determine who gets elected to the mayor's office and city council, which is what happens now. And I checked the numbers historically over the last decade plus. That's what we get in our city elections in these odd numbered years and these odd months. And you compare that to the turnout of 70% plus consistently in Chicago for presidential elections. And, you know, how hard should this be? But it turns out, of course, and John and Jeff, this will be no surprise to you, that our politicians like it perfectly well when we have minuscule turnout because we know who those voters are. They're public employee union members. And, oh, yes, then we're suddenly reminded of the escalating public employee pension debt in Chicago, and not to mention at the state level, which is part of what's driving so many people out of Chicago, the rising property taxes and fees. I ran into a school teacher, John. I was down at 75th and Vincennes walking around as I do. I was pausing to reflect at the huge piles of garbage right at Emmett Till Way. In fact, I had a whole section I had to take out of the book about the sad and horrible story of Emmett Till and how it seems so greatly disrespectful that that little slice of East 71st Street was desecrated in the manner that it was. But I landed in a place called Nubian Nation, this giant pink apparition at 75th and Vincennes, where interestingly, you know, you find these little details when you just go walk about.
The interview was great with her. Yes.
Yeah. Cynthia Simmons, retired Chicago school teacher. So here's this gigantic pink building where they sell to a steady trade of customers coming in and out, black fraternity and sorority gear. Now stop and think about that for a minute, you know. There's a lot there when you dig in. And so I'm talking to this lady and she says, it's a wonderful lady. And I said, talk to me about the Latinos. And boy, it was remarkable. She admires them. She had a lot to say as she was speaking very frankly about the Latino work ethic, about the black community. I was just like, my gosh, you just go talk to people, you hear things, and it's not the standard BLM line, not one bit. Why don't more people get off their duffs and go wade into the community like this? But one thing she said is, you know, listen here on the South Side, you know, you just pack your SHIT and you go. You go to Utah, you go to Texas, you go to Tennessee, or at least to the suburbs. It's just not tenable anymore. And this is a woman who, when she was a child, was raised in Auburn Gresham, right near where this store is. And she remembers a very different time. And she was not the only person I spoke to, John, who recalled sort of wistfully a time when the neighborhoods were just on the bubble. They were integrated in the early 70s. I heard this in Roseland, too, when black people and white people were living, if not in total harmony, you know, they were coexisting and there was shopping and the neighborhood downtowns were vibrant. And of course, it was a fleeting moment, maybe. But, you know, walking through Roseland and digging into Roseland, having just been on the 11th floor of the U.S. Bank building, talking to a great guy named David Doig, who I believe ran the Park District under Daley II for a while there. David heads Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives, which sort of inherited the Pullman turnaround. And I believe that's a remarkable story, even if some of the assets in Pullman are a bit rare. They had a very large ex-industrial parcel that they're able to do great things with. Looking at the success in Pullman, and then going right next door to the old, once thriving Roseland downtown strip was a really poignant contrast for me. And I'm biased. I pick Roseland as the number one neighborhood to target for a neighborhood downtown revitalization. There's so much there if they could pull it together. But, you know, the same Michigan Avenue that, well, used to be the signature shopping strip of Chicago downtown, that same Michigan Avenue, as you guys know, runs straight down to Roseland once you get past 100th Street, and it looks like Syria there for the most part.
That's Paul Vallis's old neighborhood. He's, I think he's getting ready to, he wants to run, I think. I keep telling him not to. But we see, I think he could do the job. I mean, the city needs a manager, but we're going to get, it looks like we're going to get some, you know, based on that old TV show of the 1970s, The White Shadow, Arnie Duncan is being groomed for it by the Obama ROM machine and Pritzker Money. And it looks like we're just going to continue the long slide.
Yeah. I talked to Arnie for my book, and, you know, I don't really have the sort of, I guess, the rich day-to-day, year-to-year experience you do in this city dealing with the sort of the machine behind the machine. So I can understand your skepticism about him. But I got to say, I think he's an intelligent, capable guy, and I don't necessarily think that would be the worst thing for the city. Myself, I'd like to see Ray Lopez run for mayor. The thing about Lopez is, you know, he has called out Lightfoot on the systemic racism shtick. He has said, what we have is a borderline breakdown of the family unit. It is not racism that is killing all these young men. You know, it's falling apart in the home. Now, how many minority politicians are going to come out and say that? Maybe there's things I'm overlooking about Ray. I know he's a little bit of a showboat, but look at New York, right? Eric Adams. Yeah, I know. Curtis Sliwa. Yeah. But it's probably going to be Eric Adams. And here we have a Democrat who has background in law enforcement, who's worked as a cop. He supports police while he also supports greater accountability. He supports school choice. New York is an interesting turnabout. And, you know, he's a long way from Bill de Blasio. And so I think we need some equivalent figure to begin to lead us out of the darkness. But in the end, I don't think people are waiting around for moral instruction from politicians. It's really kind of got to be a bottom-up thing. So whether it's Arne Duncan or Ray Lopez or Lightfoot again or Paul Vallis, I mean, it's important for sure. And we need a turnabout on the city council, too. And I don't know how that happens with 33% turnout and an increasing number of socialists on the council. You know, the disengagement is what's killing us. So that's another way that it comes back to the people, as opposed to the leaders. You know, if the people will follow, if the people will lead, the leaders will follow, I guess, that old saw.
One of the chapters in your book is really interesting. It, you know, Fallow Ground, Bringing Neighborhoods Alive Again. And you kind of alluded to it a little bit with the CNI program. But the city's not without repair. I mean, it's not a lost cause, so to speak. Speak to that a little bit and what you learn in some of the characters who are doing that, boots on the ground, so to speak, revitalization.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. one of the things that was most striking to me, and this was in Pullman, and there are other places where neat things are going on, was the micro-lending program that CNI runs. And David Doig explained this to me, and it's not rocket science. We all pretty much know what micro-lending is like. But 80% of the borrowers are African-American. Chicago Neighborhoods Initiatives, I think at the time I spoke to David last fall, had loaned out about $3 million. And an awful lot of it goes to ex-cons starting delivery services. It's the Amazon economy. And whereas, you know, Chicago Teachers Union tweeted their support for a protest where a guillotine was displayed outside the home of Jeff Bezos, at the same time that we want to vilify Amazon, they've opened a large distribution warehouse in Pullman in that huge industrial park on the old steel facility site. And CNI's micro-lending program is giving Black ex-convicts usually $20,000 at a time loans to buy vans to run Amazon deliveries. And yeah, it's hard work. You might even have to pee in a bottle, you know, to hit your quota. But these guys can make real money working long hours. And often what David Doig told me is they'll come back to borrow a few more bites at $20,000 each and expand their fleets because they've got friends now who want to drive for them. So you know, that kind of stuff is fantastic. Over in Englewood, I thought Daryl Smith was a real interesting story. He's a guy who basically espouses a bootstrapping ethos. And, you know, I went to Google and I looked up bootstrapping and white supremacy, and there's about a million hits, you know, and a million experts telling you that the notion of punctuality and bootstrapping is, yeah, emblematic of white supremacy. And this is what we're in, guys. And you know this, but Daryl has lived it. And, you know, he and his father would clean out basements and then sell stuff on Maxwell Street. He's run tow trucks. He gave me the snow shovel gospel. John, you guys would love this. He said, look, in Chicago, if you can't make it, you can't make it anywhere. Look, guy, here's what you do. If you're stuck, you buy a snow shovel. We're going to get some snow. You make some money, you save as much of your money as you can, then you buy a snow blower. Now you're doing parking lots, you know. And as we're sitting there talking in his backyard in Englewood, And it's a lovely block, by the way, with an herb garden and a vegetable garden. Even the empty lots are manicured. I thought all this was kind of interesting, kind of like broken windows. He's pointing out guys going by and he says, oh, yeah, that guy, he runs, you know, he runs a little trailer where they sell great Italian beefs, you know. And then later, Daryl's taken me on a tour of the whole neighborhood to a branded apparel store, a nonprofit cafe. I mean, the guy's just all over it. And he owns 10 residential properties. And here was an eye opener, right? A few of them he inherited from his grandfather, who worked in the U.S. steel plant and repaired boilers at night, and also from his father, who worked in the Oscar Mayer plant. They're both gone now. Daryl's, you know, bought a few more. He owns 10, you know, three flats, six flats, two flats. He's doing pretty well. He can move to the suburbs. He doesn't want to, but his story made me pause and reflect. I'm like, boy, if he was white, we'd be calling his story white privilege. So is his story black privilege? Bottom line, I said, no. It's a reflection of a family's life well lived. Well, that concept should be able to be applied across racial groups, right? So maybe now we have a fresh perspective on what's called white privilege. I think about my grandfather, Jacob, who got out of Western Ukraine just a step ahead of the pogroms. And then the Nazis came in 1941 when my father, Milt, was still in high school, hadn't even gone off to Brooklyn College yet. And they killed 21,000 Jews in the woods outside Rivne, the town in Ukraine my grandfather had the foresight to escape from. And, you know, my dad worked for Peanuts for a long time as a college professor. And my mom was a social worker. Yeah, my college got paid for. Okay, so there's my white privilege. You know, my parents had it decently together. So we, again, a lot of stuff goes back to the family and the household. And we just need to tear down the racial walls around our conversation in Chicago and be able to speak honestly about the things that parents and mothers and fathers need to do so that the city can pull itself together.
But Matt, how can you speak honestly when the language of the left, and I mean the Jacobin neo-Marxist left, is repeated again and again, either through directly or by assumption in the media of today?
It's hard. You know, I did something. I did my own critical theory analysis of Chicago media reportage, John. You'll like this. I might even write a paper and publish it in an academic journal. So
you didn't see that in the book. Did I miss it?
No, I had to leave that out. I had an editor who was really at me with the lash. And by the way, great editor and a very interesting man named Adam Bello. Little bit of a connection there to Chicago himself. I left that out. But what I saw was, yes, there were examples of bias for sure. And, you know, there's a certain type of story they assigned to the intern at a daily newspaper that shall remain nameless, where, for instance, you know, somebody in a minority community is worried about a census undercount. And there's a big story that census undercount could increase systemic racism. The premise being that minorities might not get all the government benefits they're due if there's a census undercount, which is, you know, beautiful, typical construct that the success of minorities depends on government handouts. So you see stuff like that and a whole lot more that supports your assertion, John. But I have a competing theory, which I call the broken shards of beach glass mosaic, which is if you look closely enough in a lot of these stories that are in the dailies and you get down to the 20th paragraph, the truth is there like shards of broken beach glass of different colors that you find along the shores of Lake Michigan. For instance, after the mass shooting in Englewood in early June, if you got down to the 28th paragraph, there were black elders, you know, 40-ish, 50-ish, 60-ish people being quoted saying, this is insane. We can't keep living like this. What is going on here? The younger people in our community have no respect for life whatsoever. So you know, the truths sort of bleed through. So I think the media's work has been double-edged. There's been a lot of stuff, even pertaining to race and violence and families and parenting, that again and again comes out. Just looking at the two dailies, in the comments from the community about the violence that is going on, the truth is out there. It's just a question of whether our political establishment wants to acknowledge it or not. They don't want to talk about, you know, the role of families, the role of parents, and where parents are falling short. But this is what's responsible for the violence racking up our city. These 13, 14, 15-year-old boys that are out there killing people, carjacking, the armed robbery crews popping out of carjacked SUVs on the near north side, the near west side, the guy with the hammer on the CTA, the random stabber on the north side. You know, it's just gone way off the tracks, as you know, and well, the whole city knows.
When the government becomes the daddy, the street gangs become the brother. And we'll have to leave it at that. Matt Rosenberg, pardon me. I loved your dad, by the way. Matt Rosenberg, his book, What Next, Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Son. You can get it online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
Should jump in, John. It's not available in bookstores. We got to market quickly through something called print on demand. So it's Amazon and Barnes and Noble online only. People can just go to either site and enter What Next Chicago, and it'll be in their house within 2 days.
Well, that's great. And thanks for the correction, because we have to get books sold that you can write your next one on the media in Chicago.
Ha ha. There's an idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thanks, Matt.
It was a real pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you for having me on. God bless you.
God bless. So with all the carjacking going on, the crime going on, and the race politics going on, and the refusal of many of the political class to deal with what's really going on and the real problems, like the destruction of the family and the imposition of Kim Fox's brand of justice, I just want to thank Matt Rosenberg for his book, What Next Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Son, and for a Native Son, and for sharing some time with us here.
This is very good. A very good read. It's a deep, firsthand look at Chicago and what's where we are today is versus where we were. And it even has some ideas about where we moved to, you know, what we always talk about the tough stuff here and how do you fix it? And this has all of it. So it's certainly worth a read.
So for Matt Rosenberg, author of What Next Chicago? Notes of a Pissed Off Native Son. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, my friend and master baker, cat lover. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, columnist at johncastnews.com. I finally got it right, Jeff. Thanks for being here on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.